You're listening to a Hebrew in Israel podcast with Yoel Halevi, exploring the language, culture, and history of the Bible. For more information, visit us at HebrewInIsrael.net.
Shalom everyone, you are here again for another episode of Tzohar LaMikra. And this week, unlike what I said earlier, I decided to go ahead and do a new recording for Bamidbar. And the reason I decided to do the new recording for Bamidbar instead of relying on what I originally planned, which was to just now recycle the recordings I've done up to now throughout the last year, or use previous recordings that I have from Talking Torah, for example, that we did 2 years in a row, where the second year, by the way, was more my insight and less talking about certain ideas which are going around in the world of Torah keepers, more focused on, you know, talking about the text itself. I decided to redo the recording for several reasons. First of all, because the first recording was me testing out the whole idea, and therefore, out of something like 15 or 20 minutes, which is now is considered to be very short for what I do, because now most of the recordings are over 15 minutes, I spoke a lot about my plans and my ideas, and therefore only about 15 minutes were actually the discussion itself. And also, since last year, certain questions have been reintroduced into the world of discussions that I'm involved in, and I decided to expand upon these discussions because I can actually connect them to Parashat Bamidbar. So first of all, what's very interesting to me, at least, is the fact that the Septuagint decided, or Septuagint, or the Vulgata decided to call the book of Bamidbar, where we usually call books named after the first parasha, they decided to call it Numbers because they were trying to go more for the what was actually going on in this parasha, while in the Hebrew we call it Bamidbar, which is obviously not the first word in this parasha, it's actually the fifth. And there actually are traditions that call it Bamidbar Sinai, and even Sefer HaPekudim, which is very similar. Sefer HaPekudim, Pakad, is to account for, and sometimes also act upon. For example, it says, Va'adonai Pakad et Sarah, the Lord accounted for Sarah. It really means that he paid attention to her and also turned around to her to help. And therefore, the principle of noticing and acting upon. We actually find that there was some kind of a tradition amongst Jews to call it the book of accounting or the book of numbers. But the name that really stuck throughout the centuries was really Bamidbar, and there's a very good possibility that that happened because that the Vulgata decided, and basically the Catholic Church decided, that they'll call it numbers, and therefore there was a want to move away from the more Christian name that was given. Or in truth, a name that was already in existence in Judaism, is just they decide to go a different direction. And the book itself, I mean, the entire book, you can actually look at it as being one of the historical books of the Torah, where, you know, Genesis is a historical book. Exodus is already a combination of historical slash law, and then Leviticus being completely law, and then suddenly again going into a book that deals a lot with the history of the people of Israel. Really, when you think about it, the Torah itself is mostly composed from history, and not really everything is law, but really the principle of what exactly is law, what exactly is Torah, which is really instruction. Instruction doesn't necessarily have to be just legal terms and legal principles. It can also be moral instructions, which is really the point of presenting any piece of history here. So the first thing that I want to deal with, and this is, you know, more closer to me as an historian, is the part that deals with understanding the principle of history in the Bible. One of the things that a lot of scholars deal with is, what is the place of history in the Bible? Or why is history presented? Is this just an accounting of what happened, or is there really more of a message being presented here? And it is understood, again, in scholarly circles, that there was a type of editing of all the material, specifically from Genesis all the way to the end of Book of Kings, which basically is 9 books, that there's this overall idea that goes through, an overall message that goes through that builds up as the choosing of Israel, but also the responsibility Israel has upon itself, leading all the way through into the destruction of the first temple, giving us this idea that there's this overall covenant that has to go through everything from the beginning of creation all the way through to the point where Israel reaches its destruction, and that the editors of the books, which really more I would say connect more to Joshua onwards, using principles which appear in the Torah, were trying to give this observation to generations to come, that they will understand why things happened, why the destruction happened, where did we go wrong, and how do we fix it, and what are the things that we can learn from our mistakes throughout our history as a people. And this is considered to be what's known as the historiography of the Book of Deuteronomy, or the Deuteronomistic school. And though there is an argument, obviously, between different scholars, exactly where do we fit this and everything, I, as a more of an observant Jew, and as a more as a man of faith, I have to reject a lot of what they say about this, not from the principle that I think, oh, because I'm a religious person, I'm going to reject this, because I actually do see a lot of flaws in the theory. However, from Joshua onwards, you can actually see that principle, and you can actually see hints in different places in these books to this idea of Israel needs to recognize where it went wrong to be able to learn these to the future. And basically the same thing as many historians wrote, especially, for example, Edward Gibbon, who wrote about the demise of Rome, which is kind of similar to in idea of where did we go wrong back then as Europeans, and not repeating those mistakes. And he actually, in his introduction to this very large collection of books that he wrote about Rome, he goes in great detail what happened here, what happened there, with obviously talking about Rome itself and the history of Rome, but also with a great focus on where things went wrong with Rome, so Europe doesn't repeat itself, because he felt that Europe was going again into some kind of a demise, like the Roman Empire. So we have, why are these historical pieces actually mentioned in the Torah? Why is it only just, you know, like we have in the ancient Near East, where there's just a law code and history is a separate piece? It's put together because there's this whole principle of covenant being placed together, squeezed together into this one larger principle, that you have your history, which tells you what actually happened. You have your laws, which are part of the structure of how you conduct yourself as a people of covenant. And then you also have the words of the covenant itself. So these are all squeezed into one place, and they are to be read as one piece, instead, unlike what, for example, certain scholars want to play around with, where they say, oh, this piece came from here, this piece came from there. Actually, you have to think about it as being something that's actually one large principle that's built from several moving parts. And when you understand that, you actually understand why everything has to show up together. But this is why also you have opening pieces and closing pieces. For example, I had a friend ask me, why do we have the Book of Genesis at all? And I said, because it's part of what's known as the prologue. It's the introduction to a larger piece, which really goes from Genesis and actually goes all the way to Exodus 20, where all of that is just a buildup from earlier history of the world all the way to that pivotal point where Israel stands in front of Mount Sinai and receives the covenant, which is to be a light, which also this covenant and its stipulations are to be a light to the rest of the nations as well. Another subject that comes up a lot, which just really connects directly to this parasha, is numbers, numerals in general. So there are a lot of things that I keep on seeing in, basically on Facebook. That's one of the ways I'm able to see without having to scan entire websites. and go over the internet to see what other things people are saying, one of the things that comes up a lot is the usage of numerals. First of all, Hebrew, like any other language, has names for numerals. What's very interesting is Hebrew actually does have a word for zero. A lot of people say that the Arabs invented the zero. It's actually not correct. There is first of all, there are systems of symbols for numbers which date even earlier than Roman numerals. One of the things that we find very commonly in the first temple is the usage of the Egyptian numeric system, where there are lines, horizontal lines, tilted lines. You have almost a triangle, and so on. Different symbols that represented numbers, and they were very common, especially in Judea, where the Egyptian influence seems to be a lot more common than, for example, in the north. And though I think, if I remember correctly, in the ostracons of Samaria, some of these numerals also show up. What it seems to be the Arabs actually invented was a symbol for the zero. And on the other hand, a name for a zero, the principle zero, was well known. The only thing that was lacking was actually a symbol. That's the first thing. The second thing is that the numeric system in Hebrew, a lot of people talk about the letter equivalent in numbers. And I actually received an email literally like a week ago or something from a listener who asked me about, numerals and, why do we have numerals? Why do we have letters which are equal to to numbers? And first of all, this is a very, very late invention, and people try to spin off of this a lot of different ideas. Originally, when people wanted to mark numbers, they actually had numbers for it. What happened was that in the Roman era, we start hearing about this thing known as gematria, maybe even from the Greek era, from the Hellenistic period. We hear about this principle known as gematria. The term itself, gematria, or gematrion, is not even a Hebrew term. It's actually Greek. And the idea was that in some of the schools of philosophy, some of the schools of thought in the Greek world, they were looking for secret meanings through giving letters numeric values and reinterpreting those words to mean something else. The idea of gematria is that I take a word, I figure out its numeric value, where Aleph is 1, Tav is 400, if I use what they do in Hebrew, Kaf is 100, Resh is 200, Zayin is 7, whatever, and I figure out the numeric value of that thing. And then I say, okay, this is the numeric value, and then I start looking for another word that has a similar numeric value as an overall numeric value, not the precise numbering of the letters, because that really requires me spelling the word the same, but really using the same overall numeric value and finding a parallel word and basically say, oh, look, they're the same, they have the same meaning. So the classic example everyone uses is the word Elohim and the word Teva. Elohim comes up to a certain number, Teva, which means nature, come up to the same number, and it concludes, oh, nature and God are the same, which is, by the way, a very Greek way of thinking, thinking that the divine is in nature, where in truth, when you look at earlier thought about God, God is actually external to nature. And God actually is, you can see the deeds of God in nature, but you don't see God himself in nature. It's a subject by itself. But for example, Rav Saadia Gaon, who was a 10th century Jewish rabbi, was also a philosopher. Many of these rabbis are also philosophers, says that one of the things about God is that God is outside of time. And therefore, if God is outside of time, he's really outside of our existence. And you look through the books of the Bible, and you see that God acts through nature, but you don't really hear that God is nature. Thinking that God is nature is a very Greco-Roman or even pagan way of thinking. Like, for example, people equated Dagan as being the god of fertility, but really also represented grains in general. Baal being a storm god, Zeus being a storm god as well, basically taking elements of nature and making them into a god. And this is why this specific gematria is something I find to be pretty offensive in general, because this one specific, the one Elohim and Teva, because it actually plays off of a very pagan idea, which is not necessarily something we find in Jewish history, I mean, early history or the Tanakh. So people play around with this all, and they talk about how amazing it is that letters have numbers and everything. And I ask a very simple and a very objective question. So what if I can give a numeric value to a letter? Why does that make it unique? Just stop and think about it for a moment. Why would that be so special? I can do the same thing with the English alphabet or any alphabet on earth. So why do people try to sell things as being, oh, look, this is so amazing, by using such a false idea? I can literally do this with any alphabet on earth, okay? And probably come out with similar results as well. The attempt to find uniqueness in places where there is no uniqueness is, I think, first of all, I think comes from a real place where the people are looking for meaning, which is one of the epidemics of our days, where people are looking for meaning. But I also think comes from a very naive place where people don't stop and think about the logic of what they just said. Does it really make any sense what I just described here, that I can do this and I can do that? I mean, again, it's trying to connect things which are not really connected to one another, which is, by the way, a very common thing that happens with people's exegesis to text and so on. This is Gematria and Midrashim in general are all part of this development that happened in the Jewish world during the Hellenistic and then the Roman era, where people were trying to create connections and create interpretations based on what I would call misuse of material. Instead of going for what did the writer actually intend in his text, people wanted to go into an external interpretation of the text that doesn't necessarily have to do anything with the text itself. By the way, this method is a method which you do find in some scholarly circles and is heavily criticized by most scholars, because it is a method that wants to read a text completely and utterly detached from its original intent, and therefore enables the person to reinterpret a text in whatever manner they want. So in other words, when someone opens up a prophetic piece, wherever it might be in the Bible, they can literally read into it whatever they want. And no matter what argument you might use to explain the text as it really is, that argument will fall short, because the person you're talking with is anyhow in the intent of interpreting things differently according to what they want. And I ask a very simple question about this. If God had a certain opinion or a certain idea about what he said in a certain commandment or a certain piece of prophecy, you've basically torn God and his will out of the words and basically are now molding the text to your own will. I ask a very simple question. Is that man-made, or is that by God? I ask this about anyone who uses this method, no matter where they're from. I mean, I can say this against things that happen in Judaism and also against things that happen in Christianity. By the way, this argument also going on in Islam as well. There are arguments amongst themselves as well regarding interpreting texts, which are, you know, what do they actually mean, and then reinterpreting them to fit what they want it to fit. So when people talk about, you know, what does the Quran really say about something? It really depends who you ask, and really depends what method of interpretation they use. And this, I think, is one of the great curses when it comes to studying Tanakh with people. And this is why I decided at one point in my life to take the historical approach, because at least in the historical approach, I actually have a context that's concrete. While a lot of interpretations, no matter where they're from, try to take a direction which has nothing to do with what was really being said. And though I understand the need to try to find a message that might talk to people at the time, which I think is still a very correct way of working when you're, for example, talking to a crowd and you're going to try to use a verse to create an anchor, for example, like in Midrashim, to create an anchor for people to to remember and understand the principle that's being presented. But at the end of the day, you still have to admit that a verse still means one thing and not more than that, unless the text itself enables a double meaning, which is also possible, something I point out to students sometimes, that there is a way sometimes how a text is worded or the statements are constructed in a way where they can actually mean more than one thing, and that's acceptable. But at the end of the day, when the Torah says, "Lo tirzach, thou shalt not murder," it means murder. And it doesn't mean, any killing of a person. Remember, there was back in the 1800s, the 1700s, where people started asking questions about executions, but saying, there's an over usage of executions in European circles. And people were starting to talk about, that it's too much and the government is being very murderous. And there were people who started using, Lo tirzach as making an argument that killing in overall was forbidden. But again, first of all, Lo tirzach is murder, which is a completely different principle, versus sanctioned killings by authorities out of a public need. And that's one of the things. Executions are done out of a public need, not out of personal vendetta or something like that, except for the specific manslaughter, which appears with people have to run. But people also are able to run away to refuge cities. So it's only if the member of the family is actually able to get a hold of that person. And it really isn't, it's not considered to be an execution. It's more of a blood redemption, which is something I expanded upon when I talked about the refuge cities. But you see that they took a commandment in the Torah and basically started corrupting it and making it into thou shalt not kill, which means don't kill anyone in general. So you have to be very, very careful with these interpretations. And for example, a very interesting case that I saw not long ago was the writings of Tertullian about idol worshiping. And Tertullian forbade, we're talking about this is like second century Rome. Tertullian was a Christian writer, but he also saw himself as a Roman. So what did he do? I mean, he has a conflict. On the one hand, he looks at the Bible and the Bible says not to make any images and so on. And he actually wrote very, very against any imagery, making statues of different things, and even icons, even Christian icons, he was very, very against, which basically he created the basis for the iconoclasm of the 7th and 8th century in Byzantine Rome, in the Byzantine Empire. And those who don't know what iconoclasm is, it was basically icons were acceptable from around the 5th century in the Eastern Empire. And about 150, 200 years later, there was a move inside the church governed by, and I can't remember who it was, but there was a struggle between the West and the East, and the East decided to attack the icons under the influence of, I think it was the Empress of the time, that she almost married Karl the Great, and then they decided to give up on it. But there was about 50 years, I remember like 50 or 20, 20 to 50 years of struggle inside the Eastern Empire over, are we allowed to use icons or not? And there were monks going around smashing icons and so on. It's been over 2 years since I studied this material, but that's more or less the idea of what was going on. And but what Tertullian also did, because he saw himself as a citizen of Rome, he actually permitted any practices that were directly connected to the empirical cult, basically the worship of the emperor. And because he saw himself as a Roman, he could not give up that principle. What that actually created is a very interesting debacle in the early church that ended up allowing the usage of icons and statues. Because the moment you allowed a little bit, then people played off of that and built more and more and more. And the allowing icons and allowing statues was actually the catalyst to completely removing Torah from any Christians. But at that point, the times of Tertullian, there were still plenty of Christians, even not necessarily Jewish, who were keeping parts of the Torah. And after that point, and a couple of centuries later, that was the focal point, allowing pagan practices, that was the focal point that basically broke off the Torah completely. Now, obviously, there were other things that were going on, turning Rome into a Christian empire, recognizing Jews as the enemy because Jews were also rebelled a couple times against Rome. So there was this overall anti-Semitic tone amongst the writers, like the Roman writers, and but also the church being very afraid of Christians who decide to follow Judaism. Basically, when I'm looking, for example, the Hebrew Roots movement, that's basically the same idea. And the church is having a fit about this. And it's a very similar thing. I mean, the Hebrew Roots movement is not something new. There's always been something like that in the background somewhere. As a person I once met several years ago, I think it was like 10 years ago, I met this guy who referred to himself as an Ebionite. He said, you know, he's a Christian and he believes in keeping the Torah, but he also believes in Jesus. And I said to him, so you're basically the same idea of the type of Christians that were going around here at the end of the first century and the second century and the beginning of the third century. And he said, yes, that's basically what I am. So it was very interesting to speak with him. And but the church went out of its way, and really most of anti-Semitism, by the way, and the attitude of the church towards Jews is mostly about politics. Almost 95% politics. They were very afraid of Jews. They were very afraid of the fact that the people were converting to Judaism. They were very afraid of the influence Judaism had on the on groups that were far away from the Christian centers and did come in contact with Jews. So they demonized Jews to allow certain things. And there's like misinterpretations of verses deliberately to cause a rift between Jews and Christians. And also Christians refused, Jewish Christians refused to help their own brothers in certain struggles. So that caused a tur as well, tur from the Jewish side as well. But that's already a more of a discussion about Jewish and Christian history. Now, when it comes to numerals, there are a few other things that have to be pointed out. And one of the things that comes out as well when we deal with this material is that numerals can be presented either from an order of going down to up or up to down. And you can actually find both in the Bible. Because I have students who ask me about this. And really, when you look at it, you can go like, you know, 120 and 100, which means 121, or you can say 121. This method of going from right to left to right, as we can kind of call it, or basically from the low to the high and the high to the low, is actually very common in the ancient world. And we actually find, for example, in Arabic, if I remember my Arabic lessons, which were many, many years ago, but from also hearing Arabic in general, in Arabic, for example, numerals also go from the low to the high. So this was something very common amongst Semitic languages. Now, the real reason I want to talk about numbers this week is because of the numeral one. I remember years ago receiving an email from a lady who wanted an answer about the number one. What does the number one actually mean? And she said, can it mean more than one? Back then, my answers were a little simpler. I didn't go into complex details about you know, what exactly things are. I mostly did, you know, if I did lessons with students, then I'll be more into detail about, you know, what exactly each thing means. But today, you know, I think that there's an obligation here that I have to expand upon these things just a little bit more. So what is the problem with the numeral one? In truth, the problem really stems from two things. The first thing is the fact that, like many other words in Hebrew, a word can have more than one meaning. And the way the numeral one is used, if it's used as an adjectival function or a nominal substantival function, is it a cardinal or is it a is it being used as something else and so on? It's a regular numeral, depending on the function. The other thing it stems from, and this is, and again, I'm not planning on being offensive to anyone here, but is the struggle inside the churches to try to rationalize the belief in the Trinity and trying to believe also in, you know, maybe having God as one, but having God having several parts. Now, I do know that there are people who use, for example, Kabbalistic writings that talk about the Godhead and everything, but I have to point out that most Jews barely know what the Godhead is, because it's not really part of mainstream Judaism. It's really part of the more Kabbalistic sects, which are, you know, they've only really been having real merit the last 250 years, especially with the exposure of Hasidut that opened up certain gates of study that were closed to the majority of people. But really, when you look at Judaism, the principles of faith throughout the centuries, everyone talks about God being one. One with no separation, with no parts. Obviously, the idea of saying no separation, no parts is a polemic against Christianity, but what it does show us is that Jews in general never believe that God has more moving parts than just one. But when we talk about something in the divine realm, something in the spiritual realm, what does one actually mean? And that's one of the difficulties that people had. So we just have to work with the principle of one as it appears in our physical world. So the first meaning of one is just one as a cardinal number. I have one pen or one pencil, and that's it. The simplest meaning, and that's usually the answer I gave people. It's just, still, it just means one. Then the word one, you know, you can find one in different places. Like, for example, you have Judges 13:2. It says Ish Echad, one man. But really what it means is one, a certain person. So this is already a use that goes a little bit outside of just saying there is one. Then it becomes what we can call a definite one. So we have the indefinite one that we use just to indicate a numeral meaning. And then we can have one in the sense of definite in with a certain thing. There is a specific certain item or person that we are referring to. Sometimes one can be used as an emphatic principle. It's still being used under the idea of one, as a sense of something that's like a specific or one thing. But then, for example, it can be implemented in a sentence as to be emphatic. For example, it says in 1 Samuel 2:34, it talks about the death of the two sons of Eli. It says, "Beyom echad yamutu shnehem." They will die in one day. Or one single day, they will both die. As some translations might put it. So again, we have one as one, we have certain, we have single, okay? But we're not straying away from the idea of it meaning one. Still, the principle of one exists. This is actually a rule that I point out about Hebrew all the time, that words still remain more or less in the core idea of what they are. Then one can be used a little bit like a cardinal word, like, for example, first. Okay, for example, it says, in Exodus 39:10, it says about the stones, the setting of the stones in the Hoshen, it says, Hatura Ehad. It talks about Odin Pidal Vareket, for example, the three first stones in the row. But it's really the one row, which really means the first row. First still means one, but now it's one more in the sense of one out of several. And if it's in a row, it can also refer to the idea of being first. Then we have cases where the word can mean only. Now, this is an interesting one. There is a famous argument used regarding the Shema. It says, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. And there's a question, how does the word Echad in this construction really mean? So it says, listen, O Israel, that's really more of an introductory piece. Adonai Eloheinu, the Lord is our God. And then does it mean the Lord is one in the sense of the same principle of faith as God is one with no other parts? And really what we're looking at is what we can call extreme monotheism, or actually, yeah, extreme monotheism inside the circle of Israel? Or can we translate as only? And by the way, there are actually about five different translations for the word one here, but there are two famous ones. Do we say the Lord is our God, the Lord is one, or the Lord is our God, the Lord only? In other words, it's in relation to the word Eloheinu. Do we look at Echad, Adonai Echad, as an isolate, or do we see it in relationship to the previous piece that's before it? The Lord is our God, the Lord only. And it then becomes an interpretation. Is it possible that it's not an extreme monotheistic principle, but actually says to us, he is our God, and it's only him. I know that some people jump out of their seats when I use the word God. I've had people write to me about this. I use the word God because I'm speaking in English, by the way. And it has nothing to do with the word God, by the way. Ha'ochim lagad shulchan, those who put a table, spread a table for the God. It's nothing to do. God is from the word got, which is gotu, which is a Germanic word. It means God, basically. Elohim. So that's a very, very interesting case. Another uses that we have is, for the meaning once. Pa'am achat, one time, which really means once. Or you have the indefinite use. Like, for example, when God speaks to Abraham and tells him to go sacrifice Isaac, ala hadarim asher eka, one of the mountains, a non-specified mountain at the moment. Sometimes echad can mean a togetherness. So for example, echad and yahad. So people try to play off of that yahad means, a togetherness, and therefore the word one can also mean more than one. So first of all, yahad and echad are not the same word. Yahad actually comes from an Aramaic root, which is had. Now, had in Aramaic also is really, in Aramaic it means one. In Hebrew, yahad means a togetherness, that there is an element of oneness together through the intent of doing things together, but you're still seeing people as individuals. And therefore, echad and yahad are not the same word. They come from the same historical root, but they develop differently. And yahad means the idea of binding things together as if they're one, but it doesn't eliminate the fact that it's actually built from more than one. Then we have the term ahadim, which is a pluralization of the word echad. And people say, what do you mean pluralization of the word echad? Well, the pluralization, again, stems from this principle of yahad, that there are several of them. Actually, ahadim, refers to more than one, but it refers to individual units. So, for example, we have in Genesis 11:1, when it talks about prior to the Tower of Babel, it says, "Vayu safahat v'dvarim achadim." They were one language, and several ones of things that people were communicating about, meaning that they had a grouping of ideals that they lived by, but these grouping of ideals were also things that bind them together, that made them into a type of one. So this is, I think, one of the places where the confusion becomes even greater with the term yahad and ahadim, where there is an element here of combining several pieces together into a type of single, but not a singularity. So it's as if it becomes one, but it actually becomes the idea that there's a principle of unity. So if we really talk about anything about yahad and ahadim, it's really the principle of unity, not the principle of merging into one thing. And I really think that's one of the main places where most people have difficulty with questions, and it's manipulated to mean more than what it actually means. So it's very important to understand that, what exactly is the way these words are used, and you can't just play off of whatever principle you want and say, oh, that fits there. It happens so many times when I teach students that they try to connect words to one another. They try to take a principle from one place and use it in another place. And I keep on seeing this all the time. And I'm not criticizing anyone specific here or attacking anyone specific. I'm just saying, when people tell you something about Hebrew, you have to be very, very careful with what they're using, because they can tell you about the meaning of a word and so on and make a big long fuss about it. But at the end of the day, you can like point out to one or two mistakes that cause the whole thing to tumble down. And I never had that. I actually had to one time actually write to a friend who came up with his entire teaching, write an explanation why what they wrote was a problem. And they actually read through it and they said, oh, I understand the problem. And they went through and redid the whole thing and realized that what they were teaching was wrong and they accepted it. But there are people who insist. I think one of the worst things I've seen lately is that there are people who come from, you know, a very strong theological background, and they will use Hebrew to prove whatever theology they have. And they will start telling you, well, how do you know that that's what it means? What it means? And I tell them to their faces, you know, how do you know that what you're saying now in English is what you think it means? You can't argue arguments like that. You have to bring evidence. You can't just invent the evidence. You have to look what the material tells you and conclude. That's how biblical Hebrew was actually analyzed. First of all, because there was an existing tradition of reading and understanding. That's the first thing. But the problem is that people mixed in a lot of theology into it because Hebrew was spoken by the Jews and everything. So people, a lot of people were reluctant to actually consult Jews and what things actually mean. But obviously there are things that change throughout time, and not everyone remembered the exact meaning of biblical Hebrew. Now, I'll never forget the situations where a lecturer can start talking about a verse in Hebrew and someone might jump up and say, yeah, but that word means such and such. And the person talking has to explain that's in modern Hebrew, in biblical Hebrew or Mishnaic Hebrew, it means something a little different and so on. So it's not something uncommon, but it's still very important to understand that Hebrew didn't die. It maybe not have been an actual spoken language as a dialect that I would use today, like, for example, it's known as Israeli Hebrew. But you have to understand that Israeli Hebrew is a direct descendant and is a very, very close relative of biblical Hebrew. There are some changes that happen, and people ask me all the time about the differences between biblical Hebrew and modern Hebrew, and there are differences. But when Hebrew was revived, like, for example, by Eliezer ben Yehuda, their intention was to base the language on existing word vocabulary, existing grammar, and just maybe adapt a little bit more to European grammar where, the structure of verbs, tenses of verbs, and so on is a little different, but the principle is still the same. So it's very important to pay attention to who is the speaker, why they say what they say, to kind of look at the record of what they've been saying throughout the years. The same thing that I recommend usually for when you want to read a book. First of all, check who the writer is. I've had friends who spent a lot of money on books and they were very disappointed when they discovered that a certain writer is really more of a pseudo researcher and really you can't trust almost anything they say. So it's very, very important to remember to look at the person who's teaching, how they teach, if they mix in theology and things, that to be very, very careful with that. It doesn't matter if they're Jewish or Christian or whatever, Messianic, that's not really the point. The point is that you need to pay attention to the methodology the person uses in the way they argue things to make sure that what you're receiving is the technical side of things without mixing in beliefs and so on. And as you can see, I didn't mix in my theological faith here, except for pointing out what Jews, for example, say about the word one. And, for me, from the way I have to explain things, I have to be more technical and avoid theology to make sure that what I say is as clean of my personal beliefs as possible, though it's not 100% possible, but I do try. In any case, so as I said, I made this special recording because Bamidbar deals a lot with numbers and people do have questions about numbers, and I wanted to address that. From the next week, unless I suddenly decide to change my mind a little bit, but I'm very doubtful about that. My plan is to, from that point on, recycle the recordings from last year. So the next parasha is really something. The quality of the recording also will be a little bit lower because I was using a simple recording device. These days I use a proper microphone and a computer program. So I do apologize, the quality is lower and maybe a little more difficult to listen to, but that's what I had back then. Obviously, if you have any questions, you can ask me either on Facebook, preferably try email, hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. Also, I have openings, loads and loads of openings for my Bible class on Sunday. We are in the middle of the book of Shmot. We are actually ending the book of the covenant, which is chapter 23 at the moment. But there's plenty of room there. A non-expensive class, something that will help you expose yourself to Hebrew more. You don't have to know Hebrew, but obviously if you know a little bit of Hebrew, it'll be easier to follow certain things. But we go through the Hebrew, I translate, I discuss words, I explain things if there's any special grammar that has to be explained. Students, people who join the group are part of the discussion, and you know, people raise, I saw this translation, that translation, but there's also a lot of background, this history, anthropology, and so on. So, you know, I highly recommend this class. Your entire family can join for the price of one. You can sit in, you can invite friends over to listen as well. And really just it's per grouping of people, which means there's no limit to how many people can actually sit in the room. Though I do prefer that people don't invite their entire neighborhood, because again, it has to be, you know, there has to be a certain proportion there. But highly recommend it. You can find details on my website, HebrewInIsrael.net. Don't forget to visit the YouTube channel, Hebrew in Israel. And if there are any questions, any comments, you can leave them either on the SoundCloud or the YouTube channel. And I'm going to point this out. Of late, they're having people who left very offensive comments because they have some idea in their head about things. And I'm saying it in a sarcastic way because I think that the fact that you have an opinion doesn't mean that you have the right to be offensive. So I actually have been monitoring what people write, and I have deleted. And I say this, I usually prefer to people to leave what people say, because I want people's opinions to be there. But if you be offensive, you will be deleted. I will monitor and block people. In any case, without not ending with a nasty tone, I want to wish everyone a Shabbat Shalom. I hope everyone enjoyed this. And again, if there are any questions, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. Kol tov.